Oh, I nearly forgot. He reached once more into his pocket and withdrew her notebook, the one with her Jane Frere story in it, the one she'd left behind when she and Jane had fled Thornfield, the one she thought she'd lost forever. "Where did you find this?" she gasped. "It was in Miss Eyre's room. I picked it up after my duel with Rochester. I thought you'd need it back. I imagine it's going to be a famous novel some day."
"You didn't read it?"
"I read a bit." We know, dear reader, that this was a fib. Alexander had read it from cover to cover, some of it 3 or 4 times.
"Oh,"
she didn't know what to say. He ducked his head. "I'm sorry, I was unable to resist. I found it quite compelling, truly. You should finish it." He put it into her hands. She clutched it to her chest for a moment and then slipped it into her jacket breast pocket. It was handy, she admitted, to have a jacket breast pocket. "You think you might have time for some casual writing?" His eyebrows lifted. She grinned.
"You never know."
The sun was sinking fast as the group approached the palace. Charlotte's nerves were jittering. At the gatehouse of St. James's, they stopped.
"Who goes there?"
asked the chief officer from behind the gate.
"Jane," said Mrs. Rochester.
"C'est your cue."
Jane lifted her chin and stepped forward.
"I am an agent of the Society for the Relocation of Wayward Spirits," she announced. "I'm here on urgent society business. I need to speak with the king at once."
"And who are they?"
The guard narrowed his eyes as he looked around at their assembled party.
"This is my entourage," Jane's voice wavered. "I'm the star agent."
Mr. Blackwood coughed uncomfortably.
"Very well."
The guard stepped aside and let them pass, and then they were inside the palace. It had been the fastest storming of a castle ever. In the great hall, they found the king on his throne, surrounded by lavishly dressed nobles, eating fistfuls off a tray of sweets. The room was easily the most extravagant that Charlotte had ever been in. The high ceilings were embellished with real gold leafing. The carpet had the look and texture of red velvet. The walls were covered in a wine-red wallpaper, and every few feet were adorned by large portraits of the past kings and queens and other various royalty. Beside her, Charlotte heard Jane draw in a sharp breath.
"Are you all right?" Charlotte asked. "I've never liked red rooms," her friend said darkly.
Charlotte made a mental note to ask her about that some day. It could be good material for her book. She was so excited that she was now going to be able to finish her book. She could practically taste the ending. We know the feeling.
"Your Highness, an agent from the Society, here to see you," announced the guard. "She claims that it is urgent."
Charlotte gave her a little nudge. Jane moved forward again.
"I'm Miss Eyre, Your Majesty. If you will recall, I was here to see you recently."
The king eyed Jane.
"No, can't say that I do recall."
He glanced at Mr. Blackwood.
"But you're somewhat familiar. You look like someone's father."
"I have one of those faces," Mr. Blackwood said. "I look like everyone's father."
So now came the tricky part, the getting the ring off the king's finger part.
"Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, sire," Jane said a bit awkwardly.
"Again." She stepped up to the throne and held out her hand as if to shake. The king took it reluctantly. Then he gasped and drew back as if she'd bitten him.
"Did you just attempt to steal my ring, young lady?"
he puffed. Well, it had been a long shot, the simply getting the ring approach.
"I only need it for a moment, then I'll give it right back," she said.
"How dare you! Guards!"
he cried. And then they were immediately surrounded by a dozen guards with swords and guns.
"Well, that was fast," remarked Bran. "No time for niceties or anything."
"On to Plan B," Mr. Rochester said quietly. "Take them out of here," the king ordered. "Now, perhaps a few days in the stocks would be appropriate."
Charlotte hoped Plan B was going to work. Otherwise, it would be an unpleasant weekend.
"We require that one ring," Mr. Blackwood said. "It's my ring," said the king. "It's my precious, and I think I know you, sir. You are Mr. Blackwood, and you are Mr. Mitten. We will be taking the ring now," continued Mr. Blackwood smoothly. The king smirked. "You and what army?"
"Precisely," Mr. Blackwood sighed.
"Miss Eyre, it's ghost time."
Jane cleared her throat.
"Hello," she said a bit timidly, glancing around her. "It's so nice to see you this evening. Would you perhaps, if you're not too busy at the moment, assist us?"
You should command them, Mr. Blackwood said, out of the side of his mouth. Call them. Order them to your side.
That seems rude, she sighed. Oh, very well.
She raised her voice. Hello? Can you hear me? If you can hear me, please come toward the sound of my voice. Mrs. Rochester came to stand beside Jane.
Allez, leurs spirits,
she said in her musical French creole. Come! As far as Charlotte could tell, nothing happened. But then, Bran smiled.
It's remarkable, isn't it? He murmured, shaking his head at the wonder of it all. There's so very many of them.
So many ghosts? Charlotte wasn't the type to be frightened by spirits, but the idea of there being so many ghosts all around them was a bit unsettling. What a place was London, where you only had to call out, and in seconds ghosts came from every direction. It was a city crowded with both the living and the dead, even the palace.
That's probably enough, ladies, Mr. Blackwood stretched out his arms to the main guard. Now the book.
Oh, the book. Jane lifted the book, opened it, and spoke the words in a clear, loud voice.
Ostende nobis quod est post-mortem. Nos videre prestigiae.
It was basic Latin. When Charlotte had translated it for them earlier, calling on her Latin studies at Lowood, she'd come up with the following meaning. Show us what it is beyond death. Let us see the ghosts. Which felt a bit on the nose, really, as magical incantations went. A little disappointing, if she was being honest. But then she supposed all of the real power stemmed from Jane. And perhaps the book. The book was very interesting. When Wellington had mentioned the Book of the Dead, Charlotte had expected some large and ancient tome written in hieroglyphs or Sanskrit, full of spells to control the dead and a secret knowledge of the underworld. But for the most part, this slim volume was a simple instruction manual on how to manage ghosts, protect oneself against possessions, and guide wayward souls in their journey to the place beyond. Observations compiled by the various leaders of the society, stretching back throughout the years. It was not a magical book, although we would argue, dear reader, that all books are slightly magical, but it was certainly useful. The point was, the Latin worked. The air seemed colder, the candles flickered, and then whooshed out. The guards and nobles immediately began to shout in alarm. Charlotte lifted her spectacles and gazed around the throne room again, and this time she saw them, dozens, perhaps even hundreds of spirits all around them, the people of London who had long since passed. Bran was right. The sight was truly remarkable. It seemed to her that every period in English history was represented in this crowd of ghosts. There were men in knee-length fur-lined tunics with floppy hats, women in long flowing gowns with draping sleeves and veils over their hair, women in pointy cone hats, men in tri-cornered caps, knights in chainmail and knights in plate mail, and English soldiers in red coats, a band of unruly Scots in plaid kilts with blue-painted faces. A radiant girl with red hair caught Charlotte's eye. She was dressed in a gorgeous embroidered, jewel-encrusted gown and an Elizabethan headdress. In her hand she held a book. She smiled sweetly at Jane and reached for the man beside her, who, to Charlotte's total astonishment, suddenly turned into a horse. The horse transformation alarmed the poor guards especially.
Guidrash! Someone yelled. What is this witchcraft?
Another cried.
Oh, we haven't bewitched you, Mr. Blackwood clarified. We simply helped you to see things a bit more clearly.
The ghosts advanced. Charlotte shivered. Up close, on some of them, one could see evidence that they were not truly living beings. Some of them were translucent or glowing a strange, unearthly green colour. Others bore the wounds of the injuries that must have killed them, a noose around a neck that was bent at an odd angle. The black pustules that marked a bout of plague, an open, bleeding wound in the chest. Still others looked as though they had just dug their own way from their graves. Their flesh was rotted, their clothes hanging from them in tatters. They were frightening, Charlotte concluded, especially that horse. The crowd obviously felt the same way. Pandemonium broke out. The nobles stampeded toward the exit, often pushing right through the ghosts, which spurred them on in their frenzy. Mr. Blackwood darted off to one side, pushing and exasperating the situation in whatever way he could. Bran and Jane and the Rochesters went off in other directions. It was all going according to the plan. Except then, Charlotte's glasses were knocked from her hand, which was not the plan. The plan had been for her to creep up to the king during the confusion and snatch the ring. It had been decided that she should do the snatching because she was the most unobtrusive of the group. For once, being little and obscure was going to serve her. Only now she couldn't see a blasted thing.
Blast, she yelled. Why can things never go according to my plan?
She groped about on the floor for her spectacles.
Miss Bronte, she heard Mr. Blackwood call out. Any time now?
I really should get the kind I wear on my face, she grumbled as she searched. This vanity of mine is going to be the death of us all.
She encountered the barrel of a small gun and thrust it away from her. She'd never liked guns. She found a discarded ivory fan. It was probably expensive. She grabbed a woman's ankle, and the woman screamed and tried to kick her.
Blast!
But then her fingers touched glass, and then the handle of her spectacles. She quickly whipped the spectacles up to her eyes, and her mouth dropped open. In the time she'd been searching for her blasted glasses, the room had emptied, save Mr. Blackwood, the Rochesters, Jane, and Bran. And the king. The king was still seated on the throne, surveying the scene quite calmly, and beside him was the Duke of Wellington. For a moment, they simply gaped at him.
"Well, that was an amusing little display," the Duke said finally. "But do you take me for a fool?"
"I would never take you for a fool," Mr. Rochester growled. "A traitor, yes. A two-faced, serpent-tongued blackguard. Absolutely. But not a fool." "Now, now, no need for name-calling," said the Duke. "Why don't we all just sit down and have a little chat?"
Charlotte felt Mr. Blackwood coil like a spring beside her.
"We've talked enough. Give us the ring," Wellington tisked.
"I wish I could say it's good to see you, dear boy, but you not being dead right now is inconvenient for me."
"I trusted you," Mr. Blackwood's voice betrayed his agony at the Duke's deceit. "I thought of you as a father to me when my own was gone. And all this time, I should have sought revenge upon you."
"I never did like your father," said the Duke. "He was the sanctimonious sort. It seems the apple doesn't fall far from that tree. Now, sit down."
He drew a pistol from his waistcoat and pointed it at Mr. Blackwood with an expression that made Charlotte's heart beat fast.
"Please," he added.
But Mr. Blackwood had drawn his own gun. Where had he gotten a gun? For a moment, the two men faced each other down, but then the Duke smiled and swung his arm around so that it was pointing not at any of them, but at the king.
"Put your weapon down or I will murder him," he said. "I've done it before. George III was such a bother, and David here won't mind. He'll just inhabit the next in line for the throne. I already have that all arranged."
Mr. Blackwood took a step forward. Wellington cocked the pistol.
"I will do it. I will be very cranky if I must do it. It'll cost me time and immeasurable effort, but I will. And then you'll be responsible for the death of a king. And when the guards arrive, I will tell them that you killed him. And who will they believe, I wonder?"
Mr. Blackwood's arm dropped. "We could duel," he said softly. "You and me. Here and now. And then it would be over." The Duke shook his head.
"I know how good you are, my boy. I taught you myself. No, I think not. If we dueled, one of us would die. Probably you, but why chance it? And besides, perhaps I was hasty in trying to dispatch you earlier. You're of more value to me alive, dear Alexander. I've always been fond of you. If you would only see the importance in what I am doing here, we could be allies once again. Help me, support my cause. Surely you can see all that I've accomplished and all that I will accomplish as Prime Minister and as advisor to the King."
"So it's true," Mrs. Rochester said. "You mean to rule England?"
"Of course I do. The King is a moron, the members of Parliament only more so. The people require a firm hand to guide them, to lead them."
"We will never join you," said Mr. Blackwood.
"Speak for yourself," said the Duke.
"Never," said Mr. Rochester.
"Never again," murmured Mrs. Rochester.
The Rochesters took hands.
"Jamais. This time we will stop you," she said darkly. "We will see this evil ended."
"You two have always been tiresome," the Duke said. "I should have done away with you at the same time I dealt with his father."
Mr. Blackwood gave a choked, furious cry, but did not, to Charlotte's surprise, attack the man who had killed his father.
"You will pay," he growled instead. "You will pay for all of it."
The Duke ignored him. He turned to address Jane.
"Miss Eyre, I meant every word I said about how much the Society needs you. I would entreat you to stay in your position with us, serve as my star agent, my beacon of light, and help me to usher in an era of peace and prosperity, the likes of which this nation has never seen.
Go to hell, said Jane, which was really shocking language for a woman of this time, but she was obviously starting to become annoyed at people telling her what to do.
Oh, well, perhaps, Mr. Bronte, the Duke moved on. I could reinstate you immediately. You could be a credit to your family instead of an embarrassment.
He is a credit to our family, Charlotte said before Bran could answer. The Duke's eyes flickered to her.
And you, the charming but unfortunately near-sighted sister, you could be initiated as well. I am sure you could be quite useful to us. In some way I haven't yet discerned. Did you know that I'm your uncle?
He chuckled darkly.
I had two miserable sisters once.
What? Charlotte gasped, shocked. Our mother?
I'd be willing to make you my heirs. Think about it, that £20,000 a year after I die. You'd be rich.
£20,000? Came Helen's voice from behind them. Oh, Helen, you can't take it with you, said Jane. Go to hell, Charlotte enunciated plainly. The Duke smiled.
Oh, dear. Do you at least have my book? You checked it out, Miss Eyre, but you did not return it in a timely fashion. Give it back to me at once, or there will be consequences.
A shudder made its way down Charlotte's spine. There was nothing so disturbing to her as an overdue book, possible fines. It was very scary. Jane held up the book of the debt. We're going to keep it, thank you. You've clearly been abusing its power. The Duke sighed dramatically.
Well, this puts me in a rather awkward position. I, of course, wish to remain as I am, as the Prime Minister and the caretaker, you might say, to the King. You obviously mean to stop me and will not be reasoned with. Therefore, I must get rid of you. The easiest way would be to kill you all. I have a gun, but then so do you, and I find that I am outnumbered. Obviously, that won't work. He sighed again. So I'm afraid I'll have to stick to my initial plan of killing poor old William the Fourth.
He was still aiming the gun at the King's head.
All right, said the King. But it's going to hurt, isn't it? Only for a moment. But then you'll put me back into the next King, the white-haired man said slowly. Yes, after I frame Mr. Blackwood and his friends for regicide. Wait a second.
King Mitten hesitated.
Isn't the next in line for the throne actually a woman? It's a girl. Victoria, I think her name is.
The Duke chuckled.
As if a woman could ever rule a country without a man behind her secretly pulling the strings.
Charlotte's mouth opened. That doesn't make sense. Elizabeth was a great queen.
But a girl?
Mitten looked doubtful.
You'll get to be young again and beautiful and rich, said the Duke.
But the man who resembled the King was frowning deeply.
I don't think I would be comfortable, you know, in a woman's body. You'd get used to it, argued the Duke. No, I wouldn't. Even being in this old fellow is a bit odd. His back aches from all the sitting, and he has too much hair in his nose, but at least the equipment's all the same. I don't want to be a girl. You'll be what I say you'll be,
Wellington sounded angry.
Now hold still. No!
The King, or the ghost inside of the King, jumped to his feet.
I don't want to be a girl. I won't. You can't make me.
The Duke scowled and tried to shoot him, but at that moment, Mr. Blackwood darted in and grabbed the Duke's arm, at the same time that Bran leapt forward and tackled the King to the floor. Charlotte's heart seized at the thought that her brother might take the bullet himself, but instead it shattered a rather expensive-looking vase in the corner. The Duke shoved Mr. Blackwood back and pointed his gun at Jane.
"Don't move or I'll shoot her," he cried.
Everyone, even the King, who had continued to repeat how he did not want to be a girl, froze. The Duke smoothed his hair back.
"I know you love her," he sneered at Mr. Blackwood. "Even though she's so remarkably plain, you love her, and if you try to get at me, I'll kill her right before your eyes."
"What?" Charlotte squeaked. "What did you just say about love?" "Him," Jane said incredulously. At the very same moment that Mr. Blackwood said,
"Her? You're obviously in love," said the Duke. "You kept talking about her, how resourceful she was and quick-witted, and how you wanted her to be an agent, and you..."
He turned to Jane.
"You were so devastated when I told you that he was dead, because you..."
She's more of a friend, is all, said Mr. Blackwood. But we're not...
Right. They're not in love, said Charlotte. You're reading it all wrong.
I have a thing for Rochester, confessed Jane. It's not healthy.
Mr. Rochester coughed uncomfortably.
My dear, I am so sorry at what my brother put you through while he was in control of my body. I couldn't stop him. I wish there was something I could have...
Oh, no, Jane said demurely. I know it wasn't your fault. I would never blame you. Mr. Rochester gave a short laugh.
Thank goodness. I'm old enough to be your father, aren't I? As a matter of fact, we have a...
And you love your wife? Mrs. Rochester added loudly. He turned to gaze at her.
Yes, I love my wife, more than anything.
That's wonderful, murmured Jane. I'm so happy for you.
I feel we're getting off topic,
interrupted the Duke. But then he didn't say anything more. Instead, he grabbed a large painting from the wall. This one actually turned out to be one of William the Fourth himself, and hurled it at them. They ducked, and the Duke took the opportunity to flee, screaming for the guards that there had been an attempt on the life of the king.
"He'll go back to his lair, I mean his library," Mr. Blackwood cried. "It's just across the park from here. We should try to catch him before he gets there."
Mr. Blackwood clearly wanted to go after him, but there was still the issue of... "The king," Mrs. Rochester said. "Is he all right?"
"I don't want to be a girl,"
whined Mr. Mitten, slash the king.
"That wasn't in the agreement."
"You don't have to be a girl," Bran said kindly, "although the dresses are pretty."
"He's getting away,"
hissed Mr. Rochester. "Go," Charlotte said. "You and Jane can go after Wellesley. Bran and I will see to the king, and then we'll catch up." Mr. Blackwood gave her a grateful smile.
"Come on," he said to the Rochesters and Jane. "Let's go catch a duke."
Then they were gone. Everything seemed dreadfully quiet.
"Time to get this ring off you," Charlotte said, taking the king's hand. But he pulled away.
"If you take the ring off, I'll go back to being dead. I don't want to be a girl, but I don't want to be dead again either."
There was no choice. Charlotte and Bran had to hold the man down and wrestle the ring off his finger. But that was a problem too, because the king's fingers were rather fat, and the ring was a bit tight, and it wouldn't simply slide off. They tugged and tugged, the king squirming and hollering the entire while, but they couldn't remove the ring. Their efforts had caused the finger to swell, and Charlotte was getting impatient. Every minute they wasted here was a minute she could be helping Mr. Blackwood grapple with Wellesley.
"Perhaps we could try lathering it with soap," Bran suggested,
but there was not a bar of soap to be found.
"Soak it in cool water."
That didn't work.
"Butter?"
He held the king down while Charlotte went to look for some, but she could not find butter.
"I found something else."
She'd been acting logically when she'd suggested that Mr. Blackwood and Jane go after Wellesley. Jane was gifted with ghosts. Mr. Blackwood had training in fighting and whatnot. Charlotte knew how to direct Bran, but it was figuratively killing her that Mr. Blackwood could be in danger, and she wasn't there. She was out of time. She pulled the pair of garden shears from behind her back.
"I think this will work."
Bran's face went milky. The king started to struggle more than ever, but Bran held him.
"Charlie, be serious.
You can't mean to."
"I do mean to."
And she did. Without another moment's hesitation, she knelt beside the king, positioned the shears, and snipped the finger off. The ring and the accompanying finger skittered across the carpet. The king's eyes rolled open, and he went limp. Charlotte used his coat and a string from a nearby velvet curtain to bind his hand. She'd read something about amputation in a book once. She felt a bit woozy on account of all the blood, but she soldiered on.
"Keep it elevated," she instructed Bran. "When he wakes, give him the finger."
"The finger?"
Bran was looking a bit green himself. She handed it to him. Then she turned for the door.
"Charlie," he said, "where are you going?"
"To Mr. Blackwood, of course. I have to go to him. Now that I've got him back, I'm not going to lose him again."
35. Jane. The night air hung wet and cold above them, but Jane couldn't feel anything except her heart racing. Mr. Blackwood was running a few steps ahead of her, and a few steps behind her was Bertha Rochester. Mr. Rochester brought up the rear. Helen floated among them, calling out words of encouragement. They were headed toward Westminster.
"Wouldn't he want to hide?" Jane had asked Mr. Blackwood.
"I know him. His ego won't let him believe he's in any sort of danger."
Jane's foot caught on a tree root and she stumbled, but righted herself before she hit the ground. Mr. Blackwood turned to make sure she was okay, but then he tripped and fell flat on his back with an oomph. Jane scurried to his side and held her hand out. He took it, bounced up, and they were off again. Mr. Blackwood, with a slight limp. Mr. Rochester, due to age, was falling farther behind.
"Keep going," he shouted.
"Mr. Blackwood," Jane said breathlessly, "if the Duke knows that you know that he'll go to Westminster, are we running straight into a trap?" Jane said.
"But I know something he doesn't know."
"What's that?"
"I grew up in this place. I know of a secret tunnel."
They continued the run through St. James's Park, which Mr. Blackwood said was a shortcut to Westminster. When the looming spires appeared in the night sky, Mr. Blackwood took a left toward the river. Jane followed without question, mostly because she was too winded to form more words. Mr. Blackwood turned right at the river and then darted through some trees and finally came to the base of a wall where there was an iron grate.
"Here it is," Mr. Blackwood said.
"Wait, that's not a secret passage. That's a coal chute."
"I know," he panted. "It's just always sounded more exciting calling it a secret passage. Don't worry, it's an easy slide."
He picked up a large stick on the ground, dug around in the dirt for a moment, and then pulled out a long iron rod.
"It's still here."
He wedged the end of the rod in between the chute door and the wall and pulled. The door creaked open.
"We'll sneak in and use the element of surprise to our advantage. If we approach him from an unexpected direction, I'm sure we can overtake him."
Jane furrowed her brows and looked at the dark and totally uninviting coal chute. Helen was next to her, shaking.
"What's wrong, dear?" "I can't go in," she said. "This place feels the way Mrs. Rochester's room felt."
Mr. Blackwood nodded.
"Of course, the Society knows how to protect places from ghost entry. Helen will have to stay behind."
"Be safe," Helen whispered to Jane.
"You too," Jane said. She glanced at Mrs. Rochester.
"Should we let the men go first?" she said.
Mr. Blackwood nodded.
"I'll be there when you all land."
Considering where they were at that moment and the mess they were in, Jane took no comfort in those words. By this time, Mr. Rochester had caught up. He held the chute door open as Mr. Blackwood went through it. Jane went next, feet first, into the chute. It was a short trip, and contrary to what Alexander had promised, she landed hard on her feet, her knees buckling. Pain shot through her legs. Mrs. Rochester landed next to her with a disgruntled sigh.
"Mr. Blackwood?"
Jane asked.
"He is indisposed," a voice said. It was the Duke, the flickering light of a candle illuminating his face.
And there was Mr. Blackwood, next to him, with a knife at his throat, held by none other than Grace Poole.
"And you thought your little passageway was a secret," the Duke said.
"Don't come down, my love," Mrs. Rochester shouted. But in the next moment, Mr. Rochester landed next to her, eliminating their last hope that someone on the outside could save them. The Duke, along with Grace Poole and several guards, led the four of them to a large and ornate room.
"Welcome to the collection room," the Duke said.
The room was made up of shelves, aisles and aisles of them, and on the shelves were all sorts of objects. Pocket watches, urns, necklaces, rings.
"Talismans," Jane said.
She turned to the Duke.
"Why bother bringing us all the way up here? We know your evil motives. Why not just kill us?"
Mr. Blackwood shot her a harsh glance. The Duke used his pistol to urge the four prisoners against a wall.
"Miss Eyre, you and Mrs. Rochester are beacons. I still don't think you understand how exceptional that is. Why do you think I kept Mrs. Rochester alive all those years? With Grace Poole keeping her captive? I would sooner destroy priceless works of art than damage a beacon. Pliable ghosts like Mitten are rare and take a painfully long time to cultivate. Since you are here, I assume you have depossessed the king. Frankly, I don't have the time or the inclination to groom someone new. And I won't need to. With the power of the influence of two beacons, this is your last chance."
"Ha!" Jane shook her head. "There is nothing in this world that could induce me to assist you."
The Duke raised his revolver and pointed it at Mr. Blackwood's head, about an inch away from his nose.
"How about now?"
"Wait," Jane said. "If you kill him, I will never join you."
"Mercy," Mrs. Rochester said.
"Oh, I won't kill just him. I will start with Mr. Blackwood, who was like a son to me, and then I will kill Mr. Rochester, who was like a brother to me. And I will not stop there. You see, Miss Eyre, I have come to discover you have quite a few people in your life who mean something to you."
For just a moment, and much at odds with the tension of the situation, Jane felt a fullness in her heart, because the Duke was right. She had many people she cared for, more than a penniless orphan would have ever dreamed. But then the Duke cocked the revolver, and she remembered the whole kill-everyone-she-loved scenario. "Wait," Jane said. The Duke raised an eyebrow.
"Agree, or Alexander is dead."
"Wait," Jane said again, trying desperately to think of a way out of this mess, one that didn't involve the deaths of everyone she held dear. The only idea that came to her was to try and stall. "First, give me a glimpse of how the moving on works." The Duke narrowed his eyes.
"Miss Poole," he said, "bring her a talisman."
Grace Poole walked over to the nearest shelf and grabbed a jewelry box with her gloved hand. Then she walked over to Jane and unceremoniously shoved it in her face. Jane flinched and reflexively took a step back. And she felt something, a force of some sort. It wasn't coming from the box, it was coming from Bertha Rochester. When Jane had stepped back, she had stepped closer to Bertha. The box Grace Poole held began to shake. She looked at it curiously.
"What is it, Miss Poole?" Wellesley said. "Why are you shaking the box?"
"I'm not shaking it," she said.
Jane stole a glance at Bertha, who was staring at Jane with a subtle smile. Jane raised her eyebrows and Bertha nodded almost imperceptibly.
"Miss Poole, stop shaking the box," Wellesley demanded.
"I'm not," she insisted.
With Wellesley's attention on the box, Jane and Bertha took the opportunity. They scrambled toward each other and clasped hands. And that was when the entire room began to convulse with rattling talismans.
"What is happening?"
the Duke said. The guards glanced nervously at one another. A glass cup flew off a shelf and struck one of them in the head. He crumpled to the floor. The rest of the guards, there were only three left, abandoned their posts and bolted for the door. They were definitely not getting paid enough for this. Wellington's alarmed gaze fell on Jane and Bertha, and then down at their clasped hands.
"Stop this!"
He lunged toward them, but before he could separate them, a hairbrush flew off a shelf and hit him on the head.
"No possessing!"
Bertha shouted to any ghosts who could hear her from inside the talismans.
"Right," Jane said. Beacons couldn't control a ghost who was possessing a human. It would be chaos. Blackwood and Mr. Rochester watched the two women in amazement.
"Get down!"
Jane commanded them. Jane could feel the energy swirling between herself and Bertha. At the same time, she could feel it draining as the room continued to shudder. They would not be able to keep it up for long. The flying hairbrush had stunned the Duke enough for him to drop his gun, but only momentarily. He reached down and grabbed it and swung it toward Mr. Rochester, but a shoe hit his hand, flinging the gun across the room. The women were focused on Wellington, since he was the one with the gun, so they did not notice Grace Poole sneaking up on them. The servant lunged toward Bertha and tackled her to the ground, breaking the physical connection. The room went still. Mr. Blackwood and the Duke both turned toward the gun and dove for it. Each of them got a hand on it, and they struggled to gain control. Mr. Rochester flew to Blackwood's aid, but the guard who had been hit with the glass cup had regained consciousness, and he tackled Mr. Rochester before he got very far. Grace Poole was on top of Bertha, and the sheer girth of her was enough to hold her down. She put her hands around Bertha's throat.
"I've dreamed of doing this," she said. "I wanted to kill you from the start, but they just couldn't get rid of a beacon."
Jane jumped on Grace Poole's back and put her arms around her throat, but the woman's neck was as thick and sturdy as a tree trunk. Jane's slight build wasn't going to be enough. Bertha scratched and clawed at the hands around her throat, all the while making terrible choking sounds. Jane looked frantically around, but the talismans were annoyingly small. She grabbed a perfume bottle and struck Grace Poole's head as hard as she could, but the woman was a beast. Bertha's eyes fluttered shut. Mr. Rochester was subdued by the guard. The Duke and Mr. Blackwood continued their struggle, but the Duke was gaining the upper hand. Several shots went off in the commotion. Jane thought fast. She She laid down next to Bertha and grabbed her hand. The force between them was not as strong, as Bertha was near the point of passing out. Jane closed her eyes and focused all of her strength and energy on the nearest shelves of talismans. She used everything she had inside of her, every strike of her face at the hand of her abusive Aunt Reed, every gurgling sound her stomach had made through years of starvation, every friend she'd lost to the graveyard disease, every chill she'd felt in her bones due to years of nearly freezing to death, every fear she'd felt in the Red Room. She used it all. The room began to shake once again. Jane opened her eyes in time to see a string of talismans striking Grace Poole. They flew with such speed that they appeared only as streaks in the air. Bertha opened her eyes and used her free hand to shove Grace off her. The two beacons stood, luminous and glowing, their clasped hands high in the air. More talismans flew off shelves and struck the Duke and the guard. The Duke was quickly subdued, and within moments, Alexander was standing over him with the gun. Bertha and Jane finally released their hands, and both women dropped to the ground in complete exhaustion.
"You would not kill me, my boy," the Duke said in a weak whisper.
"I am not your boy," Mr. Blackwood said.
The smell of smoke reached Jane's nostrils, and it was followed quickly by the sight of flames licking up the wall on the other side of the room. During the fight, candles must have been knocked over. The group would have to escape the room, and soon. Mr. Blackwood focused on the Duke as the women tried to catch their breath. A faint voice came from the doorway.
"Mr. Blackwood?"
The group turned toward the sound, just in time to see Charlotte there, clutching her chest. Then, she collapsed.
"Miss Bronte!"
Mr. Blackwood shoved the gun into Mr. Rochester's hand and raced across the room. He crouched down and gathered Charlotte in his arms. Jane's heart fell at the sight.
"No, no," Mr. Blackwood said. "She's been shot."
The Duke used the distraction to lunge for the gun, but Mr. Rochester turned and fired. The Duke crumpled to the floor, dead.
36. Alexander. The fire was growing. Alexander didn't wait. He lifted Miss Bronte's motionless body into his arms and ran. This couldn't be happening. It just couldn't. But as Miss Eyre and the Rochesters led the way and Miss Bronte continued not moving, he had to admit that it did seem to be happening. She'd been shot, hit by one of those stray bullets. A wall collapsed, bringing oil lanterns crashing to the floor. More fires erupted, making him run faster as he carried Miss Bronte through the halls and up the stairs. He ran until his side ached, and then he kept running because Miss Bronte's face was pale and blood soaked her jacket. Sweat poured down his face. The others pushed their way outside. Even out of the building, the heat was intense. It billowed off the house in angry waves, making the lantern-lit air shimmer. Smoke obscured the night, hiding the nearly full moon. The fire would only get worse.
"Let's go!"
he shouted, but his voice was lost under the rush of flame and destruction.
"Hurry!"
Miss Burns had joined the others ahead, all of them moving quickly, and not quickly enough. People filled the streets, the fire reflecting in their wide eyes.
"What's happened?"
someone asked.
"I heard it was a ghost attack on the society,"
another person called.
"It was the king! He realized he'd made a mistake by dismissing Parliament and set the house on fire."
Alexander staggered through the growing crowd of onlookers, his heart beating wildly in his ears. In his arms, Miss Bronte was as light as a doll and just as motionless. Was she breathing? He couldn't tell. She was so still, her head lolled back and her eyes were shut. He pushed through the crowd, caught in the wake made by Miss Eyre's flying elbows.
"Make way!" Miss Eyre cried. "My friend has been shot! Is there a doctor?"
People shouted at them, telling them to stay still and watch the fire like everyone else, but Alexander ignored them all. Finally, they reached a break in the crowd and Miss Eyre cleared a pair of children off a bench they'd been standing on. Alexander settled Miss Bronte there and dropped to his knees at her side. Miss Eyre, Miss Burns, and the Rochesters clustered around him.
"What do you think?" Miss Eyre asked.
Alexander tore off his gloves and touched Miss Bronte's throat, seeking her pulse. Nothing. He let out a strangled cry.
"Miss Bronte!"
She couldn't be dead. She just couldn't.
But his bookish friend was completely still, her pale face streaked with soot and ash.
"Miss Bronte," he whispered, "please don't die. Please don't leave us."
The fire warmth of her skin was fading. He leaned in close, listening for her breath, but there was no sound of it, no evidence of life. Her black lashes fanned across pale cheeks, unmoving.
"No, no, no!"
His fingers searched her throat again, wanting more than anything to find a pulse. In the months he'd known Charlotte Bronte, had he really appreciated her as he should? In the back of his mind, without him truly realizing, he'd assumed Miss Bronte would always be in his life, always influencing, planning, smiling, writing. Oh, Lord, could he imagine her always writing? And the idea of losing her, it was a stab to the gut. An eruption tore from the building, followed by terrified screams. Alexander looked up just in time to see an enormous fireball hurl into the sky, and the house, which might have been saved before, was now completely engulfed in flames. Hot wind gusted off the building, making the crowd of onlookers scream and stagger back. That was it. The society, all its records and talismans and library, was gone now. But Alexander could hardly feel the pain of that loss, because when he turned back to Miss Bronte, she was still silent and unmoving. He bent and rested his forehead on her shoulder.
"I'm sorry," he breathed. "I should have..."
The words clogged in his throat as tears spilled out of the corners of his eyes. Was he crying? Blast it all.
"I care about you, Miss Bronte," he rasped. "And now I'm too late in saying so."
Furiously, he wiped at his eyes, but the tears kept coming, and after a moment, he let the sobs heave out of him.
"Oh, stop watching," Miss Eyre said from behind him, "and get back in there."
Alexander sat up, just in time to see Miss Bronte's ghost sniffle.
"Shush, Jane. I'm trying to listen."
But she disappeared back into her body. Then the body gasped.
"Miss Bronte!"
He cupped one hand over her cheek, feeling warmth bloom beneath her skin. Her colour lifted and her pulse fluttered.
"Miss Bronte, you're..."
She opened her eyes and looked around, though she wasn't wearing her glasses.
"Can you see anything? Shall I find your spectacles for you?"
He didn't particularly want to leave her side, but he would search 10,000 burning buildings if it meant pleasing her.
"Hi,"
she coughed a little.
"What?"
He smoothed hair off her face.
"What is it?"
"I was dead, wasn't I?"
"Yes," he breathed. "But you're going to be all right, I think. How do you feel?"
"You said..."
"Yes, I said a lot of things when you were dead."
And suddenly he was running through every word. Then he remembered. He'd admitted, out loud, yes, that he cared for her. Cared for her, cared for her, if you know what we mean. Her eyes widened.
"That means..."
"I know," he said. "I know it was forward of me to just say so, but in my defense, you were mostly dead."
"No, no, that's not it."
He was confused.
"Then what?"
"I can see dead people."
Alexander laughed and pulled out his mask, then placed it across her face.
"Welcome, Seer Charlotte Bronte."
Or rather, that was what he'd intended to say, but before he could finish speaking her name, she pushed herself up a little and pressed her lips against his. His eyes widened in surprise, and immediately she backed away from him, giving an embarrassed cry.
"I'm very sorry," she said. "I couldn't see. I don't know what came over me. That was unforgivably rude. I shouldn't have..."
"You shouldn't have?"
His heart was pounding.
"No."
"Oh."
Unfortunately, now he couldn't help but see the gentle curve of her lips, the tremble in her jaw, and the way she tucked a strand of hair behind her ear. When had she become so delicate and strong at the same time?
"It was too forward," she went on. "Please forgive me. I was just so happy, and I shouldn't have assumed anything about your feelings, and we've never discussed..."
He kissed her. It was the same as her kiss to him, just a touch of his lips to hers, a question, a hope, a promise.
"Are we even now?"
He felt the blood rising to his cheeks too, praying he hadn't misread her.
"Or should I prepare a heartfelt apology as well?"
"Don't you dare."
This time they kissed each other, for kind of a long time. Only when Miss Eyre loudly cleared her throat did they pull away.
"We're still here,"
Miss Eyre said, "in case you forgot."
"That was terrible to watch,"
Miss Burns shuddered.
"Please never do it again, at least not in public."
Miss Bronte's cheeks were a lovely shade of pink as she sat up straight on the bench.
"How are you still alive?"
Miss Eyre asked. Miss Bronte pulled her notebook from her pocket. The leather sported a large hole right through the center.
I think this slowed the bullet just enough. I always knew my life was for books.
When Alexander's heart slowed to a normal pace, he climbed to his feet and offered Miss Eyre and Miss Burns space to sit on the bench while he stood beside the Rochesters. The three young ladies, two living and one dead, all held hands as they watched the House of Lords and Commons burn against the night. 2 days later, they met in the flat on Baker Street. You know, the one that had been Alexander's but was currently Miss Eyre's, for the rest of the month at any rate, since Wellington hadn't covered the rent beyond that. Miss Eyre had generously offered the flat back to Alexander, as it had been his first, but Alexander had declined. Instead, he and Bramwell had rented rooms nearby. "Tea?" Miss Eyre asked. Everyone accepted. Miss Eyre and Miss Burns disappeared into the kitchen, while Miss Bronte and Bramwell took the sofa and bent their heads together.
"We need to decide what to do next," Miss Bronte murmured.
"I should go back to Haworth," Bramwell sighed. "I do rather miss it there. Of course, not much happens in Haworth, but that's the point, isn't it? I think we've had enough adventure."
Miss Bronte nodded. Alexander's heart twisted a little when he thought about Miss Bronte going all the way to Haworth. He'd spent the last 2 days waiting for a meeting with the King, trying to figure out the Society's future now that the building and move-on room and talismans were all gone, not to mention Wellington. But the King was still recovering from what Mr. Mitten and Wellington had done in the days before the Great Fire. The Society's future was on his list, but it certainly wasn't a priority. Not right now, anyway. Which left Alexander sort of the Society's leader by default, but not really, and because all that was so messy, he couldn't take actions like inducting new members, even if they were seers. Anyway, Charlotte had just agreed about the excess of adventure in London. Maybe she wanted to go back to Haworth. He moved toward the kitchen to help Miss Eyre with the tea. Even though she currently lived here and was technically the hostess, this had been his kitchen until recently, so no harm in helping.
"It's not that I want you to go," Miss Eyre's voice came from behind the door, barely above a whisper. "I'll miss you. Of course I will."
Alexander paused in the doorway.
"But you think I should?"
Miss Burns's ghostly voice was tight.
"That's it, isn't it? You think it's better if I go?"
He should return to the front parlour, he knew, but Alexander moved forward just enough so that he could see Miss Eyre and Miss Burns. They faced each other, their hands in each other's, almost. There was something luminous about Miss Eyre ever since the Great Fire. It was the same sort of glow Mrs. Rochester had, the light of being a beacon that even the living could see. Tears shimmered down Miss Eyre's cheeks.
"I think you've been staying here because I've needed you all these years."
"And now you don't."
Miss Burns wiped her cheek on her shoulder.
"Oh, my dearest friend, I'll always need you. But I have to think about what you need too. I've been selfish in keeping you here. Selfish in wanting you by my side. Always."
"I'm all right with that."
Miss Burns let out a small hiccup.
"I want to stay with you. I don't know what happens in the afterlife."
"It's something good,"
Miss Eyre whispered hoarsely.
"It has to be."
Alexander held his breath, watching the two, wishing he could go back to the parlour like he'd never walked in on this exchange, knowing that he could not because pieces of this conversation echoed in his heart. For most of his life, he'd carried his father's ghost with him. Not a literal ghost, of course, but the figurative ghost.
"What happens when I'm 80 years old, Miss Eyre went on. "And you're still 14.
"We'll be best friends."
Miss Burns bit her lip.
"Won't we?"
"Of course." Miss Eyre threw her arms around Miss Burns, but the embrace passed right through. She backed away, tears shimmering on her cheeks.
"We will always be best friends, forever. But our friendship isn't limited by life and death."
"Obviously."
Miss Burns forced a brave smile.
"And it's not defined by whether you're here or there. If you stay here, I will still love you. If you move on, I will still love you."
Alexander's heart ached for the two of them. His throat and chest felt tight with the tension of his own ghost. What Miss Eyre said was true, wasn't it? Death could not stop true love, whether that love was paternal or platonic or romantic. Love extended across worlds.
You think I should move on, though?
Miss Burns's voice was so small. Miss Eyre nodded. I think you deserve to find peace. Miss Burns wrapped her arms around her waist.
I'm scared of being without you.
I'm scared of being without you, too. Miss Eyre's smile wavered. But we both have things to do. I must live my life, and I can't drag you through it with me. That's not fair to either one of us. So, I have to be brave.
Me too, then.
Miss Burns straightened her spine.
I'm going to do it.
When? Now it was Miss Ayres's voice that cracked. Warm light spread throughout the kitchen, coming from Miss Burns.
Now,
she said.
I think I'm going now.
She seemed less substantial than before, more there than here.
Helen!
Miss Eyre's cry brought Miss Bronte and Bramwell to the kitchen door next to Alexander, but no one dared enter when they saw what was happening.
I better not see you for 80 years!
Tears sparkled on Miss Burns's cheeks as she looked up and up, and suddenly a wide smile formed. And she was gone. The room dimmed to a normal brightness.
Goodbye,
Miss Eyre whispered. Then Miss Bronte rushed forward toward her, and the pair embraced. We should, Bramwell wiped his face dry. I don't know what to do. Take them to sit, Alexander said. I'll make the tea. When he was alone in the kitchen, preparing a tray of cups and sugar and cream, Alexander glanced at the place Miss Burns's ghost had occupied. It was amazing how quickly she'd gone, once she'd decided to go. And she did deserve peace. Maybe Alexander deserved peace, too. From revenge. From the figurative ghost he'd been dragging through his life. From a single-minded devotion to the society. He decided to let it go. All of it. Oh, he'd stay with the RWS Society in whatever form it took. He was good at relocating ghosts, and he enjoyed travelling. But it didn't have to be his whole life. Not anymore. When the water boiled, he placed the teapot on the tray and returned to the parlour, to his friends. "Mr. Blackwood?" inquired Miss Bronte in that curious voice he was coming to know so well. "I have a question of the utmost importance." "Of course you do," he gave her a cup of tea. "It's regarding the letter that your father wrote to Mr. Rochester, the one you found when you were rakishly breaking into the study at Thornfield."
"I recall the letter quite well."
The man who wrote the letter signed his name as a Mr. Bell. He thought this detail had slipped her notice, but nothing ever slipped Charlotte Bronte's notice.
"Yes, my father was Nicholas Bell. After he died, Wellington thought it would be prudent if I chose a new name for myself."
"So your name is Alexander Bell?"
"Outside of Wellington and the Rochesters, you're the only one who knows the truth." She smiled.
"What's your middle name? I bet I can guess." He bent his head.
"You'd never guess."
"No, but I think I might. Alexander Bell. It feels there's an obvious middle to that." He tried not to grin.
"My middle name is Currer."
"Oh," she laughed. "You're right. I never would have guessed." She held out her hand to him. "Then I am pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Alexander Currer Bell." He took her hand.
"And I yours, Miss Charlotte?"
"I have no middle name, I'm afraid. The only one of us who received a middle name was Emily. Emily Jane."
"Miss Bronte, then."
"Mr. Bell. Although I suppose I must go on calling you Mr. Blackwood."
"You could call me Alexander, if you wished."
Her eyes widened behind her spectacles. "And you could call me Charlotte."
"Indeed."
Epilogue. The morning was dawning bright at the Bronte residence. Jane and Charlotte could already be found, even at this early hour, in the garden behind the house. Jane was wearing a painter's smock over a pale blue dress, and an expression of fierce concentration, as she made a series of rapid yet delicate brushstrokes onto the canvas before her. Charlotte was perched on a bench a few paces away from Jane, wearing her new spectacles, the kind that she could see out of without having to lift them, as in permanent, over-the-ears glasses. Which was a fortunate thing, as she was hard at work herself, scribbling away furiously into a new notebook, one without a bullet hole. That notebook was almost full to the very last page of the most engaging story.
"Read that last part back again," Jane instructed.
Charlotte cleared her throat delicately.
"Reader,"
she began. Jane's brow furrowed.
"Are you certain you should address the reader that way? It seems forward."
Charlotte smiled and said stubbornly,
"I'm sure the readers like to be addressed. It draws them into the narrative, makes them part of it. Trust me." "All right, then. Continue."
"Are you sure?" Charlotte's mouth twisted into a smirk. "No more suggestions for improvement of that one word I've read to you so far?" Jane laughed.
"No, proceed." "Ahem. Reader, I married him. A quiet wedding we had. He and I, the parson and clerk, were alone present. My tale draws to its close. One word respecting my experience of married life, and one brief glance at the fortunes of those whose names have most frequently recurred in this narrative, and I have done. I have now been married 10 years. I know what it is to live entirely for and with what I love best on earth. I hold myself supremely blessed, blessed beyond what language can express, because I am my husband's life as fully as he is mine. No woman was ever nearer to her mate than I am. I know no weariness of Mr. Rochester's society. He knows none of mine, any more than we each do of the pulsation of the heart that beats in our separate bosoms. Consequently, we are ever together." Jane gave a wistful sigh.
"That's so good, Charlotte."
"It's not too much. I think it might be too much."
Jane shook her head.
"It's a little long, but it's romantic. I don't think I've ever heard a story that's so perfectly romantic. Your readers will eat it up."
Charlotte bit her lip nervously.
"I don't have any readers currently, except family and Alexander."
She felt greatly embarrassed sometimes when she thought of Alexander reading the story, because so much of what she'd written about Jane Eyre's feelings for Mr. Rochester had been inspired by what she herself felt for a certain Mr. Blackwood. But then she smiled at the thought of Alexander. Jane smiled at the word family. She was part of Charlotte's family, you see, and not just because she lived at Haworth now, too, but officially. And no, this was not because Jane Eyre had married Bramwell Bronte. No, the way Jane had become family to the Brontes was the result of a funny coincidence, actually. Some weeks after they'd all returned from London, smoky and slightly singed but still victorious, a lawyer had arrived. He'd informed them that he was acting on the behalf of the estate of Arthur Wellesley, the recently and tragically deceased Duke of Wellington, who had been the estranged uncle to the Brontes, didn't they know? They did know, it turned out. Their estranged uncle Arthur had left behind quite a fortune when he'd passed, the lawyer had informed them, in the sum of £20,000. "To us?" the Brontes had asked incredulously. That seemed unlikely, considering.
"Well, no," said the lawyer.
To a mysterious person the Duke didn't know he'd ever met. The Duke, it turned out, had another sibling, a lost sister who died in childbirth long ago, who'd left behind an orphan, who'd been missing this entire time, who'd been reported as deceased herself. But it had recently come to the late Duke's attention that this girl was not, in fact, deceased. She was very much alive, a teacher at Lowood School, and to this modest little teacher the Duke had left his entire fortune. So the lawyer had gone searching for the girl at Lowood, and he'd tracked her to Haworth, where he was now seeking none other than, you guessed it, our very own Jane Eyre. It was a bit of a convoluted story, but this was the gist of it. Jane was a cousin to the Brontes, and now she was apparently loaded. Well, that had changed things for everyone. You'd think that Jane would have been overjoyed about the money. It was £20,000. But Jane hadn't cared about the money. In fact, she immediately shared her inheritance with the Brontes, as she felt they stood to receive a portion of the Duke's money equally. What had mattered to Jane, what had always been what mattered to Jane, it turned out, was that now she had family. She had actual blood relations, and she delighted in every new member of her familial circle. Charlotte and Bran, of course, Emily and little Anne, who they'd brought home immediately from school. They'd all settled down at Haworth together,
and spent their days writing stories and drawing pictures and painting and generally having the very best time imaginable. Which brings us back to Jane and Charlotte in the garden, Charlotte reading to Jane a complete draft of what was going to become one of the most famous novels ever written.
"Are you sure you don't want me to write it as it really happened?" Charlotte asked Jane.
Jane shook her head, her expression thoughtful.